And as we continue to monitor events in Orlando, we are also keeping an eye on other news. And every day this week, we're spending a few minutes talking about science in America. Yesterday, we heard from the head of the National Science Foundation about the state of scientific research and funding in this country. The NSF hands out billions of federal dollars to scientists every year. Today, we're joined by the only PhD scientist in Congress, Bill Foster, a Democrat from Illinois, a physicist. Welcome.
Well, happy to be here.
Well, and how does that feel to be the only PhD scientist in Congress? And I should say we say that because we're not including political scientists, which is kind of a different thing. But does it concern you that you're the only one?
Well, I do feel a little bit lonely sometimes. The need for scientific advice to Congress spikes from time to time. For example, during the Iran nuclear deal, I was basically besieged by members, Democrats and Republicans that were looking at the Iran nuclear deal and saying, there's this one-page table of reactor core specifications. How do we interpret that? What does it mean? And, these were things intended to show that the modifications the Iranians were going to make to their research reactor would make it useless for making large amounts of weapons-grade plutonium. And so I got a chance to actually explain that to a lot of members at the level that they could absorb. And also, I sort of felt a duty as the only physicist in Congress to really do due diligence on the Iran nuclear deal. So I think I had more than a dozen classified briefings, many of them individual classified briefings with the technical experts that provided support to the negotiating team.
So people come to you for expertise, but also this Congress has been accused of being anti-science. The majority of Republican members of Congress deny that climate change is happening and that it's caused by humans. How do you get past that if you're the only one in there with a degree of a PhD in science?
Well, I found that you just have to handle it issue by issue. As you mentioned, it's pretty hard to find common ground on issues like climate and the transition away from fossil fuels. It's just a tough subject for discussion, largely because of many of the districts that a lot of my colleagues across the aisle come from. But there are also times when you talk about more distant things in the future. Things we had, for example, I serve on the Financial Services Committee, but also the Science Committee. And so we had a very successful hearing that I initiated on human genetic engineering. These are the breakthroughs that have happened in the last couple of years that look like they're going to allow, people sometimes call designer babies that maybe in the next decade as a technical possibility. And so we had a hearing on this that I initiated. And, because that everyone, no matter what party you're from, recognizes the importance of this issue and how it has the potential to transform society and the human race, we had a very thoughtful hearing on it. And so I found in general that the farther you're talking about in the future, the more the partisan differences disappear.
But are there issues that it's harder for people to wrap their heads around or for people to think are important? There are people who are claiming that the American leadership is falling behind in areas like cybersecurity, battery technology, infectious diseases, Alzheimer's, et cetera. Are there things that you as a scientist would say to your colleagues, this is really important and it's very hard to get people to recognize that?
Yeah. One of the things I struggle with all the time is the difference between the short-term political incentives, which are all about winning the next election a year or two from now, or sometimes even less, and the long-term best interests of the country. Because of the difference between political incentives and long-term incentives, we systematically underinvest in things like childhood education and basic scientific research that have huge economic payoff, but the payoff is 10 or 20 years down the line. And so when you underinvest in things like that, your economy suffers, but it suffers 10 years from now and you just blame it on the other party.
Do you think that the U.S. is still the global leader in science and technology?
In most areas, yes. I think that's unquestionably true. But that lead is being challenged in many areas. In biotechnology, for example, when we first started worrying about recombinant DNA 30 years ago, there was a famous scientific conference where everyone got together who were experts in the field. They were all in the U.S. and a handful in Europe. And when you have to have a discussion of biotech and stem cells, human genetic engineering, things like that, it's imperative that you bring in people from all around the world. And so that's why Congress has to take a broader view of many areas of science than we used to have to back 20, 30 years ago.
How much more funding do you think would be adequate to fund scientific research in this country at the federal level?
Well, adequate is there are two broad classes of funding. There's funding that you provide to optimize economic growth, and this is sort of on the development side of things. And that you could imagine doing a calculation to calculate the optimal amount. If you spend all of your entire GDP on research and development, obviously you're never manufacturing anything, and so that's the wrong idea. And so there's some best fraction to invest in research just from an economic point of view. But there's another broad class of science, so-called curiosity-driven research, things like astronomy or high-energy particle physics, where I spent 23 years of my career. And these are things that you do not because you expect a near-term economic payoff. You do that because you want to be proud of the kind of country we are.
But how do you make the case now that it makes sense, especially with the deficits as high as they are, for us to be spending more money on scientific research and therefore less money on perhaps defense or the entitlement programs or something else that are very important to people?
Well, things like defense, you can easily make the argument that you have to stay ahead of the curve. You know, we need to maintain a qualitative advantage in the weapons systems that we have. And you cannot do that without having a qualitative edge in technology, and that means science. And so from the defense point of view, I think a lot of people agree on both sides of the aisle that the biggest long-term threat to our country's military security is losing the technological edge that we have.
So Congressman Foster, as the only PhD scientist in Congress, what is the one thing that we're not focusing attention on as a country from a scientific perspective that we should be?
I think that we have to start looking at our bodies more as as machines that we can affect the outcome of. You know, if you look at, for example, what happened in the opioid epidemic, which at this point has now killed more people than the war in Vietnam, that the mistake that we made for a long time was treating opioid addiction, as some sort of moral failing rather than a treatable medical condition. And now when you take a scientific attitude there, towards that, and you have the scientific tools that we've developed because of decades of government research, you have the ability to actually analyze this. You see, you can do functional MRI scans and see the patterns of neural activity in the brain and the differences between an addict and a non-addict. And so that, and when you see that, you can then start to develop drugs, and we are, that crowbar the cravings for opiates and alcohol. And so with those sort of tools, you can transform human lives.
Why did you get into politics as a scientist?
Well, sometimes I say that I fell prey to the family's recessive gene for adult onset political activism. My father was actually a scientist as well. He got a chemistry degree from Stanford, and during World War II, he designed fire control computers for the Navy. But most of the way through the war, started getting these reports of how many people had been killed by his team's equipment, this week. And so he came back from the war, thought about it for a while, and decided to become a civil rights lawyer. He ended up writing much of the enforcement language behind the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when one of the great steps forward for human rights in our country's history. It was actually reading his papers after he passed away about a decade ago that I first started thinking about this fundamental question of what fraction of your life you spend in service to your fellow man. This is a question, unfortunately, that science does not help you at all with. You have to look at the spirit inside you and try to understand what you hope to accomplish in your time on Earth. And so this is, you know, I have, when I've made the transition from science into politics, I've become a little more humble about all of the non-rational reasons that humans do things. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is that my decision to leave science and enter politics cannot really be justified in any scientific, rational way, but just because of a desire that springs forth inside of me to try to leave the world a better place.
That's Bill Foster, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from Illinois, a Democrat, and the only member of Congress with a Ph.D. In the natural sciences. Congressman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll continue our look at science in America tomorrow by looking at how we're educating our young people in science, technology, engineering, and math, and how the U.S. can get more women and minorities into science. We're also speaking each day with a different scientist in a different field about the research that they are doing. If you missed that on air, you can catch it at hereandnow.org, and you can leave your thoughts there as well. This is Here and Now.